Tuesday night, February the 22nd, 1983. And this is Truth for Today Bible class. And I thought that tonight I would take up a little topic called, I just called it this for, have some name for it, Overthrow to Glory. That covers a lot of territory. I just wanted to kind of tell you a Bible story, sort of an introduction to all of this. The last couple of weeks we have talked about why the mystery, and also about the power of God, which is to usward, who believe. And this goes right along, I think, with the theme that we've been using. Now, the overthrow is spoken of course, in Ephesians, the first chapter. It's translated, of course, in most of our versions as the foundation. And foundation was right in the classical Greek, which our translators had and didn't have anything else, so it's not a mistake on their part. They did the best they could. But actually, the word kataballo means to throw down, cast down, overthrow. And so, from that time, which was caused by the fall of Lucifer, the great angel of light, long before our earth was possibly created, when he came on the scene, and there was a great singing and so on when the foundation of the earth was laid, Job 38. And there was perfection back in those days, and our earth was without water, evidently, because it was overthrown with water. And so there was no dirt nor dust or anything, so they couldn't have made a man very well back then. There wasn't any dust to make him with. But this overthrow of water and so on, our beatings the earth has taken in all of these, how many millenniums and millions of years, I wouldn't know. But this Lucifer was a king, for one thing. He had a throne, and he got proud, and he decided that he would exalt his throne above the throne of the Most High. And he was a priest. He had the stones, 9 of them, the 12 that the high priest would have in his breastplate, and there were also musical instruments. You should read a little bit about him in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. And he was in the Eden of God at that time, which of course was not the Eden that Adam was in, but the Eden of God. And it was a perfect place with all the precious stones and so on else. And he said 5 times, I will this and that and the other thing, be like the Most High and so on. And that caused the overthrow. God rejected that. And so his hopes of ever getting into the heavenly places were overthrown too. And he never will. That is the Holy of Holies, the heavenly places far above the heavens that we know of. And no evil has ever entered that place. That's where God's place of authority, his seat of authority, I might say, would be. Remember, we can't limit God to any space, whatever, as far as that goes, but he does have a place of authority. The fact that God is everywhere makes God also in hell, if anybody ever thought of that. At least David thought of it in one of his psalms, and he said, though I make my bed in hell, thou art there. So, and of course, it's so surprising a lot of folks that Satan's the prince of the powers of the air. And that air or firmament is also called heaven in Genesis 1:6. So that's kind of an overthrow for a lot of folks who find that Satan's in heaven and God is in hell. Well, you have to define your terms, you see, and then it doesn't sound so bad. But when we use the terms that ordinary traditionalists use, well, that sounds pretty bad. Now, about 4004 B.C., as near as can be figured, I don't think this is too far off because different ones have figured it and come out just about the same. Adam was created and placed in the garden in Eden, not the garden of Eden, Eden particularly, the garden in Eden. Eden was evidently a vast territory at that time, and this garden was in Eden. And it was no doubt a beautiful place, from what little description we have of it, with all kinds of fruits and so on growing there. And, evidently there was a very wonderful climate at that time, and Adam and Eve didn't need any clothing to keep them from the elements, protect them from the elements. And they were privileged to eat everything in that garden, excepting the fruit of one tree. And there was another tree in the garden that they could eat of, but they never got to it. And they ate of the wrong tree. The one in the midst of the garden was the tree of life. And by eating of it, they could have extended their lives indefinitely until their probation would have been over and they'd have been changed, because we know that they were flesh and blood, and flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom. That is God's rule. It has to be a being different from that. And so if they had won out in their probation, no doubt that God would have changed them, and they wouldn't have needed the tree of life anymore then to give them life. They would have immortality, which is, of course, the hope of all who would be resurrected. They'll be resurrected immortal, incorruptible. But there's something evil gets into that garden. Now, our Bible says a serpent. It's translating a word which means a shining one. When we read these references I gave to you about in Isaiah and Ezekiel, you'll find that Lucifer was a cherub. Now, a cherub is a shining angel. And since snakes are rather shiny and so on too, the word was used of snakes. Of course, a snake would never have tempted Eve in the garden, because in the first place, she and Adam had dominion over all the animals and living things, and an ordinary snake or serpent would have no chance whatever of fooling them in any way. But the serpent enters, and Satan, and sin enters too with him. So Romans tells us that sin entered the world of one man. Sin had already been existent long before Adam, you see, when Lucifer fell. That was the beginning of sin. Well, things didn't go very well from then on. They got expelled from the garden. And however, they had hope. There was cherubim at the entrance to the garden. And evidently a tabernacle, because spoke about a sacrifice being at the door that Abel could have picked, or that Cain could have picked up and used for an offering. So evidently there was a place of worship there for Adam and Eve and for their children. And it seems that Abel was the good boy. He followed the directions, and so he offered the offering that God required, and it was accepted by fire, which is, you'll find many instances in the Old Testament where an offering was made and was accepted with fire, showing that God accepted it. One outstanding example, of course, is when Elijah was having his little contest with the priests of Baal, 400 of them. And no fire came down on their order, but when Elijah fixed his up, the fire came down and burned up the offering and the altar, and a whole trench full of water had been soaked up with, and showed that it is accepted. I bring in these because a lot of people don't understand how, if they knew that these are accepted. When the Solomon's temple was built, fire started it. I burned the first offering and they were to keep that fire going. The same thing happened when they made the tabernacle earlier in that. And so Cain turned out to be a pretty bad boy. He had ambitions, and he wanted to worship his own way. Now, he's going to worship God just the same as Abel did. He put up an altar and put a sacrifice on. But the trouble was, I don't say he put the wrong sacrifice on, because Abel did the same thing that he did. But it wasn't enough. He didn't have any shedding of blood to prefigure the coming of the Savior of mankind. And Abel did, and so his sacrifice was burned up. Well, that didn't set very well, as we say, with Cain, and it wasn't very long until he had nursed up his anger to the point that he murdered his brother. As the first murder among mankind, There have been a few since. And in Hebrews it tells us that Abel still speaks. They have the record of what he did and his acceptance and so on. So he's still speaking to people today about faith and doing the right thing. Well, we go on down a little way. We don't take up all of the patriarchs and so on of the old time, or we never would get through. But there was a man by the name of Enoch who walked with God. And he lived, as far as we know, 365 years. And God took him, that's all we know. I don't know where they took him or what. A lot of people think that he isn't dead, but over in Hebrews 11, where it talks about these folks and speaks of Enoch and others, it says, these all died not having received the promise. So evidently he died. There's another man who's living along in those days, a son of Enoch by the name of Methuselah. And he lived about 969 years. He died at the time the flood began, so then he was born 969 years before the flood. This and lots of other figures like that is how we can work out a chronology of the Bible and be pretty accurate on it. The names of patriarchs and when they had their sons and so forth are given out pretty plainly. And then we have some prophecies that have to do later on with years. Putting them all together, we have a pretty good chance of having the years outright. Then we have the flood, and Noah, his three sons, and the four wives stepped out of the ark after the flood into a new earth. The sons are Ham, Shem, and Japheth. We find Shem as the father of the Semitic races, and the father, of course, of Abraham in that line. Japheth is the father of the, what we would call the white race, and especially through the Greek and other ones of Asia Minor and Europe. And Ham was the father of the Egyptian race and others like them. Now, I will add this here. It's something we don't know. But we've never been able to connect the African Negro with any ancestor. It's just a blank. You just draw a blank. The common supposition is that they are also children of Ham, but we don't know. There's no way of connecting it up. The Egyptians were, I would say, of a Negroid type, but not like the Negroes of Central and Southern Africa. Well, I don't be surprised at that, because we can't tell you any more about the yellow race than we can about the black. And even about the red race. So, and we go into questions like that. We don't know too much. Now, the three sons had children, and the earth was soon repopulated and got to be a great population in not too many years. And up to about 1946, they had never really separated and taken into different parts of the earth. But about that time, or before it, they had gotten together, coming from the east into the land of Shinar, and built a city, name of Babylon. And they didn't want to separate. They didn't want to separate and be scattered over the world, so they said, now let's build a city and a tower and make a name for ourselves. And, of course, your ordinary translations in the Bible tell you about that. Why, lead you to believe that that tower was to be so tall it reached up into heaven. Well, that isn't what it means. It means that the Torah was crowned or topped with the heavens. In other words, circular on top with the signs of the zodiac. And these signs were items of worship. So this is idolatry. And about the first idolatry I know of was a worship of the beings in the heavens. The what we call the signs of the zodiac. Now, there are 12 main ones that they knew at that time particularly. There are 36 more, making 48 in all. And they tell the story of redemption. It's written in the stars long before a Bible was ever written for men to read. And he could read that in the stars. But you see, Romans 1, 18 to 32 tell us the story of the downfall as far as idolatry is concerned. And they didn't want to retain God in their knowledge. So they started to worship something else. And, well, they worshiped the likeness of a man to start with, and then birds, flying birds, and then four-footed beasts like the sacred bull of the Assyrians and the Egyptians, and finally creeping things, the bugs and beetles that crawled around. That's the devolution of worship, see, starting with man and getting down to beetles. And so God gave them up. Now it tells us in Genesis 11 how he came down and took a look, see what they were doing. And of course now that is a figure of speech in a way. God knew what's going on. But to tell it to man and get him to understand is put in man's language and man's understanding. And we have to watch for that. It happens many times in the Bible. And when he saw what they were doing and so on, why, he just tangled their tongues up, and they couldn't understand each other, and so they just scattered all over. And that's one thing to scatter people, and they can't understand each other. Now, that was about 1996 B.C. I would say a little later than that, because from 1996 to 1946, was a 50-year period in which Abraham was growing up. He was born in 1996, and so when the dispersion was final, he was 50 years old. And at that time, he was called to leave Ur of the Chaldees, which was not very far from Babylon, and given a promise. In other words, then, Abraham was selected by God to be an agent, that is, his posterity, at least a nation, be an agent that would gather these nations together again, and there would be one language, and one God, and so on, which is still a future thing to happen, but the book of Revelation tell you about some of that, how it's going to happen. Well, I've spent a little bit of time on that, but it's a good thing to know the basics. Now, Abraham had a son by the name of Isaac. And he was a son of promise. So, through Abraham and through Isaac would be the nations of the earth blessed. Now, Abraham had other sons besides Isaac. He had one a little older than Isaac, called Ishmael, whose mother was a Egyptian slave. And he had about 8 sons after that, like Keturah, after Sarah died. And so we have several, we would call nations, coming from those sons of Abraham. And then Isaac comes along, and the promise is given to him. He has 2 sons, Jacob and Esau. Well, both of them were a failure in a way. But of course, Esau was the worst. And from Esau, you come the Edomites. And along with the Ishmaelites, who are children of Abraham, you have the nucleus today of what we call Mohammedanism or Islam. Most of the folks who worship their God by another name, and have a Bible of their own. Most of them claim Esau as their father. They say that Esau was the older, and therefore he was the real heir, and they had the true religion. And of course it is true. But Esau was first born. They were twins, Esau and Jacob. But Jacob was given the promise. Remember that Abraham was not the oldest of the brothers. He received the promise. You go on down the line, you'll find even there's the youngest of a bunch of brothers, David, was selected to be king of Israel. So you see, God is not a respecter of persons. He didn't follow the human rules of the firstborn being the one always. Well, we have the 12 sons of Jacob. And 10 of these were in failure in that they sold her brother Joseph into slavery in Egypt. Now, just give you a quick resume of the sons of Jacob. I give them the order in which they were born. Now, the first four were born from Leah: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Reuben and Simeon disqualified themselves for being leaders by some cruelties they did. We don't told all the details. Levi was selected as the tribe from which they'd have the priesthood, and Judah, the tribe from which to be the kingship. So these are the children of Leah. Well, then Rachel had a handmaid by the name of Bilhah, and she had Dan and Naphtali. Then Leah had a handmaid by the name of Zilpah, a handmaid, a slave girl, and she had Gad and Asher. Then Leah had two more children, Issachar and Zebulun, and then finally Rachel, who was Jacob's favorite wife and didn't have any children for so long, she had Joseph, and then some years later Benjamin, and died in childbirth when Benjamin was born. That gives you the 12 of them. And since Levi was used for the priesthood and they would not have a share in the land, Joseph was divided into two tribes by his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so that made 12 portions of land. Levi didn't have an inheritance. They received the tithes and so on from Israel to keep them up, and they took care of the tabernacle and the temple later on. Just a little resume of the sons and so on. You can read this in Genesis for yourself. Now, since there was a failure in the part of the sons of Jacob, and they needed some correction, and things were so arranged that they sold their brother Joseph down to Egypt. And there he married a daughter of a priest, the name of Asenath. And they had two sons, we mentioned a little bit ago, Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph's name was changed to Zaphath-Paneah, which means a provider of bread, which he did in Egypt. We won't go into details. You probably remember the story of how he stored up grain and so on for 7 years, and that took him through the 7 years of famine. But you see, this worked out to this point that his brothers came down there to get bread, to get grain, and he kind of dragged things on and didn't make himself known to them. And so finally, when things got in a desperate condition and so on, and they were ready to say uncle, as we'd say today, got him where he wanted him, he revealed himself to them. Well, they had changed their minds about things quite a little bit and turned out to be a lot better boys than they started out to be. Now, you see how God had to whip these to bring them into line, and to have something happen to them to break them down and get them into his line. And you'll find all the way through the Old Testament especially that these things work out that way. When somebody isn't in line, then his place is either taken by somebody else or he is whipped for the place that he's going to do his duty as he should. Well, going on with that, they were in Egypt about 215 years after Jacob moved down there with his family. About a half of the 430 years given as their pilgrimage until their deliverer, Moses, should come. And so Moses comes on the scene. And here again is, he has an older brother, Aaron. He has an older sister, Miriam. He's the youngest, but he's the one who's chosen to be the deliverer of Israel. And we will skip over most of the story where they leave Egypt. They're crossing the Red Sea. And they're sojourning in the wilderness for 2 years, receiving the law and so on, and going down to Kadesh Barnea. And there they failed right off. Didn't have faith enough to go into the land, even though God had destroyed all their enemies before them. They couldn't believe it. I don't know. It seems to me that man is one of the most skeptical things that's on earth. I've handled animals a great deal and so on, and I find that animals will have faith in a person and accept what he says and so on much quicker than man will. Did you ever think of that? Of course, maybe folks who are listening to me haven't been farmers. I have. I've worked with livestock on the farm and so on. And, you know, I can get along with, oh, I shouldn't say this. I'm going to say I can get along with cattle better than I can with people. Well, maybe it isn't too bad to say it because I'll tell you, God used some of those terms too. You know, there in Isaiah, you had him telling the people, he said, well, my people Israel, they don't know anything. Says the ox and ass no more than they do. They know where the master's crib is. My people Israel, they just don't know. So I guess if God uses that illustration, maybe I can use it too. Well, anyway, out of all of that, about 3 million people went down into Egypt. There were 663,550 men of war, 20 years and above. And out of that bunch, 663,550, there were two that got into the land, the promised land. The rest all died in the wilderness. Well, that's a pretty small percentage, isn't it? Of overcomers. Now you know what you just hear. A lot of people tell you, oh, those folks were all lost. They perished in the wilderness and they never live again, never have a resurrection, they'll never have any reward in the future, anything about it. Now listen, folks, if you say that, you're including Moses in it too, because he didn't get to into the land either. Are you going to do that to Moses? Now just stop and think a little bit. And if you want to know the sentiments of those people who died in the land, you read your Psalm 90. It's about the folks who didn't make it to get into the promised land. And if you want to read about the new generation that comes up and they get into the land, or read Psalm 91. Those two Psalms are written by Moses. And of course, he included himself with the first group. Those who would die in the land, in the wilderness. Well, now, just some things to think about along the line. That, a little hard on the tradition sometimes, I know. Well, after they got into the land, they had a period of about 450 years that they were under judges. Now, I won't have time to go into the Lo-Ami positions during the time of judges, where they lost out on 93 years. Just to say this, that they failed five times at least that God gave them over into captivity to some of their enemies. Five times, a total of 93 years. You would think, after all the deliverance that they had from Egypt, being fed with the bread in the wilderness and protected from their enemies, the miraculous crossing of the Jordan River, the taking of Jericho, all of those things that happened, and still, unbelief ruled the day. It's hard to believe, isn't it? Is it hard to see it? But we look about us today and we find the same failures today that they had then. Not a bit better today than it was at then, as far as belief is concerned. Man hasn't made much improvement. Of course, you see, I'm not particularly an evolutionist. I'd rather be called a devolutionist. It goes the other way. Well, just for instance, the descendants of Cain, his immediate descendants, his sons, engaged in the arts, and music, and so on, and also in the working of iron and other metals. Now, where'd the Stone Age come in? Why, those folks degenerated to the place that they didn't even have their arts and so on anymore and started to live in caves and using stone implements and eating bugs and beetles. It's always the other way. Some folks like to tell you, you know, that man was improving. Well, this old world we have today is man's production, and he ought to be proud of it, but you don't hear politicians bragging too much about it. Just throwing a few things in. But finally, after 450 years under the judges, and the last of the judges was Samuel, Israel began to grumble. They wanted a king like the rest of the nations have often had. Somebody could go out and lead them into battle. They could look up to. They could put him on a golden throne and bow the knee to him and all that sort of thing. They wanted a king like the rest of the folks. Now, you folks that have children, you know, they want to do something. Well, everybody else is doing it. Well, that is Israel. Adults will say that same as children, you know. And God gave them their wish. But he sent meanness into their souls. And so they got their wish, and they got their choice. King Saul. He was a tall man. He would have made a good basketball player back in those days. Real tall. He could have made all the baskets without half trying. But he was the kind of a man they wanted. And when he was dressed up as a king, he made a nice spectacle. But we are told in 1 Samuel 13:1 that Saul was 1 year old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned over Israel 2 years. Now, you may have to go back to your Hebrew to get that exactly, because the translators have fallen all over themselves trying to get that thing straightened out, because it didn't seem to make sense. Well, translators didn't always know the meaning of the Bible. They were working with words rather than the truth. And going back to chapter 10, you will find there Samuel anointed Saul as king of Israel and told him that he would become a new man. The Spirit would rest upon him. He would prophesy among the prophets. And Saul did. Well, after this incident, which was 1 year, till Saul took the throne. So he was 1 year old as a new man when he took the throne of Israel. Well, he got along fine for about 2 years. And then he got so proud, that meek fellow that started out with, got so proud that he couldn't wait for Samuel to come and make an offering, and so he made an offering himself. His men were deserting him, and they had the Philistines there to fight, and he just didn't have the faith. And Samuel was to come and make the offering, but, well, that's what blew the whole thing. So God said it. He'd rejected Saul from being king. So the next 38 years, Saul was on his own. God didn't guide him, didn't give him any advice, just let him on his own. And so then, he reigned over Israel 2 years under God's permission and his help. The next 38 years didn't count, just like those 93 years didn't count in time of judges. And you can soon find out that when you read about Solomon starting to build a temple, he started in the 418th year after the Exodus. Well, that was 93 years short, because those captivities during judges wasn't counted in that figure. And that has puzzled folks. They say, well, that's a contradiction in the Bible. When people are low army and not his people, the time isn't counted. And so it was even in the life of Saul. Those are good little lessons to bring in. I wonder how many barren years and years that didn't count that we've had in our own lives. Something to think about. After Saul's 40 years, David came on the throne. He reigned 40 years. And after him came Solomon. and he reigned 40 years. So that made a 120-year period there. Israel had kings, all 12 tribes together. The only time that they ever have had kings. This lasted 120 years. For after Solomon came Rehoboam and Jeroboam, they split the kingdom. Now that was about 880 BC. They split the kingdom. Saul became king at 1000 BC. And so about 880 BC was a disruption. And that lasted for 475 years. And there's mighty few Bible students know that. They think that that disruption is still on. I just got some literature through the mail today, which a man was playing on that very subject. They lost 10 tribes of Israel. Well, they aren't lost. God promised them he'd take care of them. And when all of Israel, all 12 tribes, were returned from the captivity in Babylon, or we'd rather say Medo-Persia, really, because that's where they really came from, all 12 tribes are there. They built a new temple under Ezra and Nehemiah, dedicated in 405 BC, all 12 tribes together. Remember that when Paul was speaking about the tribes, he spoke about all 12 tribes serving God. James wrote to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. These New Testament writers didn't know anything about 10 tribes that were lost. That's all in men's imagination. So don't let anybody fool you with that. Just read your Bible carefully and see what it has to say. Well, Israel was the 10 tribes went into the idolatrous practices of their neighbors first before Judah and Benjamin did. And so in about 611 BC, Assyria under Shalmaneser came in and took Samaria. And they were taken captive way over into Assyria. Assyria is even beyond Babylon, a little north. The capital was Nineveh. And I remember before this happened, before Israel were taken captive over there, several years before that, a man by the name of Jonah was to go and prophesy to Nineveh. And he wouldn't go. He went in the opposite direction just as fast as he could go. He went by ship and by fish. By that time, he learned his lesson, so he was meekly ready to come back and do what he'd been told to do. And he went and prophesied to Nineveh. And Nineveh repented. And so the taking of Israel was staved off for several years. But finally, in 611 BC, Assyria took Samaria and took Israel, the 10 tribes, into captivity. And that lasted, that captivity lasted 206 years. Well, Judah didn't do too much better. So about 496 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the head of the Babylonian army, took Jerusalem. That was the beginning of their servitude, which lasted 70 years. He put a king to take care of Jerusalem, let them still stay there in their land, so on, except there were a few nobles he took away, and probably including Daniel and that bunch and other Hebrew children of the royalty. And so it wasn't very long, they had to come back, and that time he took a whole bunch of them captive. Took a whole mob of them over to Babylon as captives. Well, that didn't work very well either. There are people who rebelled and so on. You have to read Ezekiel 8 to see what was going on about that time. It's rather interesting. While the temple was still standing. And so it wasn't but a little while until he came back, and that time he destroyed the city and its wall and burned the temple and took so many out, so the captives and so on, the land was left desolate. Nobody to till it. And it stayed that way for 70 years. Now, I just couldn't imagine what my farm out here would look like if nothing was done to it, just let go for 70 years. It'd probably be grow up so thick with underbrush and trees and so on, a jackrabbit couldn't get through. That's the nature of it. Now, you can imagine what Israel had to do when they went back, finally, and under Ezra and Nehemiah, and started to work that land again. Well, all of the brush and the brambles and the briars and stuff, they had to clean off and get the fields. And one way they did in those days was to whack off a lot of that brush and let it get dry. They didn't get all of it. They let it get dry and have a dry season, then fire it, burn it, all the thorns and the thistles and stuff off of it. Then they could get it down and cultivate it some. Now we have a mention of land, the earth being burned in our New Testament, referring to that very thing, the practice. Find it in the book of Hebrews. And so they come back and built houses, and they finally rebuilt the temple in 405 B.C. They dedicated their temple. Now, when Daniel was writing before this happened, he gave some figures. He knew about some things were going to happen. See, he was in the captivity. He'd been taken right among the very first ones. He and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego. And Daniel's name was changed to Belteshazzar. Babylonian names and after Babylonian gods. And there were prophecies that Daniel was took care of some of these things. It's very, very interesting to take Daniel's prophecy and look up the fulfillments and so on of the different things he prophesied. Now, this 70 years of the desolations, particularly, was given to Daniel. And you'll find that in Daniel 9, 25. And there, after 70 years, there'd be the return. And the Lord would return. Now, that's the Lord's return that he's talking about. Daniel there is talking about it. A poor fellow. I think he imagined from what he says and so on that when they would return to Jerusalem and rebuild their temple, the Messiah would come and the great millennial kingdom would be started. And when he was told here in his vision, that it'd be 490 years, 70 weeks. I think he was just sick. What it tells about him being ill. You see, that would have put the coming of Christ and setting up his millennial kingdom at A.D. 85. Just after the Acts period was over. It could have extended on if Israel had repented and received Christ as their Messiah. And they could have had him come. Remember that Paul, Peter, and the rest of them were expecting him to come in their lifetime. And that could have been very well. That prophecy had been fulfilled at that time, but it wasn't. Israel rejected up to the very end of Acts. And so God rejected them. And so we're living in a period now that's a parenthesis in God's dealing with Israel and his earth purpose. Now, just at that point, let's remember this. That so far, from Adam on up to the point we're getting to, God has been working on an earth purpose. Restoration of things here on this earth. Now, I'm going to have to just quick there for a little bit because our time is up.